Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Jenny Bangham about her new book, The Blood Relations, Transfusion and the Making of Human Genetics. Blood is messy, dangerous, and charged with meaning. By following it as it circulates through people and institutions, Jenny Bangham explores the intimate connections between the early infrastructures of blood transfusion and the development of human genetics. Focusing on mid-20th century Britain, Blood Relations connects histories of eugenics to the local politics of giving blood, showing how the exchange of blood carved out networks that made human populations into objects of medical surveillance and scientific research. Bangham reveals how biology was transformed by two world wars, how scientists have worked to define racial categories, and how the practices and rhetoric of public health made genetics into a human science. Today, genetics is a powerful authority on human health and identity, and blood relations helps us understand how this authority was achieved. Well, Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So as we're living through the unprecedented times during the pandemic, with hopefully some end in sight, I say very, very carefully, I would like to ask, how has it influenced you and your work?
Thank you. Yes, it's been a challenging year for me, in part because I started a new job and new project last March, so March 2020, and it's been hard to contact people, and it's been hard to get access to archives, which is the main source that I normally work with. But as things went on, I began to do interviews with the people that I'm researching at the moment using Zoom. And so it seemed very alien to begin with, but now it's become a part of normal practice. So things shifted, and now they feel normal again, even though things are actually quite different to the way they would normally proceed.
So your work focuses on researching archives quite extensively. So are there more digitalized archives nowadays that you can access?
There are, but digitization is time consuming and quite expensive still. So to do the kind of archival work that's really exciting, to kind of leaf through pages of things that haven't really been looked at for a long time or that haven't been covered by other people, that's still the sort of thing you kind of want to do with the paper archive itself. However, there are some, I use the Wellcome Archives in London quite extensively, and there are some wonderful treasures there on their website, and more every month. So I do use that as well. So things are changing.
And you yourself, how have you adapted to the new setting? Perhaps you took up a new hobbies, maybe taking walks.
well, I I've got a little toddler who, well, she's now three, so she's less of a toddler and more of a small child. And so that has been taking up most of any spare time. We've managed to carve out a space inside the flat to work. And she is often being looked after at nursery, but I would say I haven't taken up any new hobbies during this. I have been reading probably a bit more than normal because of not being able to travel to places to visit archives and so on. So reading published material, I suppose that has been a really nice change.
Excellent. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yes, so I'm a historian of science and medicine, but I began my career not as a historian but as a scientist. When I was growing up, I always expected to be a scientist. My father was a scientist, and there were various other family members who were very into science. So I loved laboratories. I really enjoyed reading science. It was the era of in which people like Richard Dawkins were still writing interesting books, and there was lots of discussion about evolutionary biology and so on. And I grew up with the ambition to be an evolutionary biologist. And so I studied biology at university, and I did go on to do a PhD and work in labs. And it was very late on that I realized that I was perhaps more interested in the cultures of laboratories, the cultures of science, the social dynamics of science, than I was perhaps in the kinds of questions that my scientist colleagues were asking. And it took me even longer to discover that there was really a whole field of research dedicated to thinking about the history of science and why scientists ask the questions that they do. And once I realized that, I was lucky and able to get funding to go back to university and to retrain, I suppose, as a historian of science and medicine. So that was how I got into this field. It feels like it was always there in the background, but I hadn't really taken it seriously enough until I realized there were other people who study this.
Were there any mentors who supported you and inspired you along the way?
Looking back, I'm quite surprised at some of the people that I contacted out of the blue when I was still working in the lab. I had heard of a few people that did this kind of work, and I read some of their work, obviously. And so I sort of sent off a handful of emails to people in the field to ask their advice and ask whether this was something that they thought I could switch into. And they were very kind, these people. And they were, so Rainey Dastin was one of them. Janet Brown was another. Erica Milam now at Princeton, she was another. And they were all kind of kindly thought about what I was asking and sent back advice on how I might move into the field. So they feel like important. They were important figures in being able to make that switch.
So you are an excellent example of somebody who decided to follow her passion. So switching from science to history of science. Do you have any advice to young career researchers who may be considering taking up this career path?
It's a difficult question to answer, I think, at this time, because, as you know, job opportunities are very scarce in this field, humanities generally. So I think it would depend on the specific circumstances in which those young research investigators find themselves. There's a lot of wonderful things to read. And I think that perhaps that advice of contacting people who work in the field, who do work that that you find kind of interesting, it's worth doing. I think the people that I've certainly come across in the field of history of science and STS are extremely generous and happy to talk about opportunities and about their work, and will really invest time in trying to help people to do what they'd like to do. So perhaps I would advise to do a similar thing to me, which is to reach out to people and talk to them, to scholars.
Yeah, that's a great advice. Yeah. Just make that first step and write an email.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you've also done some editorial work. And how did you find that?
That's right, I did. Yeah, so again, when I was doing my PhD, I was working in the lab. This was at University College London. As I said, I really enjoyed the cultures of laboratories, but I wasn't sure if I was really doing the right kind of research myself. And so I looked around for related careers, I suppose. And the first opportunity I had was to work, I was actually covering somebody's maternity cover for a journal called Development. So it was a field that was adjacent to, but not something I knew a huge amount about. And it was a short-term contract. And I worked as a, well, as a reviews editor. So I was commissioning and editing review articles. And it's quite thrilling because we were choosing who to commission, thinking about talking to people at conferences, trying to work out what were the new topics that needed to be reviewed. And it really felt, I think a lot of editors who do that kind of work are really in the thick of science and sort of guiding, shaping how things, the trajectory of how things move. And I found that, yeah, pretty fascinating. And I've always felt since becoming a historian that I'd love to do more to understand the history of that work, of that editorial work. There are a few wonderful scholars who do that. And I would love to do a little bit more myself in understanding the histories of those publications and what kind of difference that they have made to the science that people do.
Excellent. So how did you get interested in blood?
Another good question. I have to say, I've always been a bit squeamish of blood. And as I get older, I get even more squeamish. I can't look at needles. I find it all a bit gory. But the impetus of getting into this story really came from my longer-standing interest in human evolution and genetics. So as I said, it was those topics were things that I sort of grew up reading about at school and at university. And when I moved into the history of science, I was really stunned to find that I now had a vocabulary for thinking about and critiquing that kind of science, to thinking about like where it come from, what kinds of claims are being made, what are the political implications of that kind of work. And I went to my prospective PhD supervisor and told him that I was interested in these questions. And he told me about these two massive archives that had recently been acquired by the Wellcome Library, beautifully catalogued. These were the archives of somebody called Robert Race and Ruth Sanger. They were a pair who worked very closely and ran a blood group unit in London. And then the other archive was closely related to that of somebody called Arthur Morant, who also ran a blood grouping lab, but who also collected vast quantities of data on the blood groups of populations around the world. So the Wellcome had acquired these archives, and I think what Nick Hopwood, this is my supervisor, what he saw that I perhaps didn't quite at the time, but then soon learned, was that blood groups were these very interesting entities that had this kind of crucial role in blood transfusion. They were critical for safe transfusions, making sure that blood was compatible between donor and recipient. But they were also these fascinating immunological traits. So there was a great scientific interest in what these entities were as immunological phenomena. But they were also fascinating genetic objects. And really one of the first clear-cut genetic human traits that scientists could study and play with, and a trait that was very abundant. There was a huge amount of data because of their use in blood transfusion. So blood groups have this sort of central position in several different fields in the mid 20th century, and moved between these different domains, and so they provided this very interesting focus for a sort of a history of human genetics that came from a different angle, that wasn't about concepts or theoretical innovations, but was about the practices of doing human genetics.
So all of this research culminated in your book, Blood Relations, that looks at the very early field of human genetics that was based on science. It was also included bureaucracy and institutions and networks and a blood transfusion. And it takes us through the decades of early 20th century and so on. So can you tell us what was the environment during the early 20th century, so 1900s, and what was the state of human genetics and blood transfusions?
Yes. So blood transfusion at that time was pretty precarious. In the 19th century, I believe doctors and surgeons had experimented with methods of transfusion using all sorts of fluids, saline, human blood, animal blood, sometimes milk, and only in circumstances of extreme danger. So people who really wouldn't survive without such a transfusion. And of course, those attempts were extremely risky. And one of the main problems for blood, for doing this sort of surgery at the time, was that when blood comes out of the human body, it clots. And it would clot in tubes and it clots in syringes, and it's very difficult to control. And that really continued to be a huge problem up until really the First World War. So there were experiments with anti-clotting agents before that time, but they were very controversial. People were very unsure as to whether they were themselves quite dangerous. But the First World War offered the conditions, as do so many wars, of experimentation on people who were very, very critically wounded. And so doctors working on the Western Front were inclined to experiment by taking blood from lightly wounded soldiers and giving it to critically wounded soldiers. And they were experimenting with anticoagulants and finding that it was possible to do that sort of operation using anticoagulants, sodium citrate, that is, and syringes. So the First World War was marked quite a decisive change in the technologies of blood transfusion. As for genetics, 1900 was a period it was an important time for certain kinds of studies of inheritance. The term genetics was beginning to be in circulation by that time. By the sort of 1910s, around 1912, 13, there was plenty of experimentation happening on plants and animals, and trying to understand the mechanism of inheritance. By the 1920s and 30s, there was enormous interest in human heredity more generally. So thinking about what kinds of traits are inherited, personality, IQ, all sorts of traits that were understood to be vitally important to those interested in eugenics and the heredity, that the state of populations. But there were very few traits, like one or two human traits that had sufficiently clear-cut inheritance to be understood as genetic. Now, as blood transfusion expanded in the 1920s, especially with the use of these anti-clotting agents, and more donors began to come forward to give their blood, the blood groups began to be seen as really important entities in the practices of transfusion, that testing the blood groups and making sure that the blood between donor and recipient were compatible was important for the outcome of transfusions. And as the number of donors grew and more people had their blood groups tested, these blood groups became the focus of quite a lot of attention from scientists of different kinds, including people interested in genetics, in heredity, in eugenics, and particularly in race science, the science of human difference. And blood groups were taken up by people in all of those fields as interesting entities for thinking about human heredity and human difference.
So how precisely are blood groups differentiated? Why are they different?
So the term blood group initially referred to, and still refers to a certain degree, to categories of blood. So if you mix blood samples from different people, they will sometimes agglutinate or sort of curdle, and sometimes they'll mix very freely and there seems to be no agglutination. In 1900, when they were first discovered by Karl Landsteiner, who much later got the Nobel Prize for this, Landsteiner found that there were patterns to those agglutinations, and he determined that human blood could be categorized into four distinct groups, A, B, AB, and O. And those groupings were quite early on understood to represent proteins on the surface of red blood cells, which were causing immunological reactions with the blood of people belonging to other groups. So they were immunological phenomena. They were also essentially symbols for understanding whose blood could mix with whom. And as I mentioned, as they accumulated on lists of blood donors and in medical records, they were sort of taken up for a range of different purposes and a range of different kinds of scientific study.
So when the human genetics and blood transfusion become institutionalized,
Did you say when did they become institutionalized?
Yeah, so early 20th century or after the war?
Right. So so these fields were pretty separate. There was the institutional link didn't really come in. My study, I should say, focuses specifically on Britain, where there was a particularly tight link forged between the practices of blood transfusion and the study of human genetics. And that happened at the outset of the Second World War, so in 1939. And the backstory to that was that in the 1930s, a group of scientists in Britain, quite influential geneticists in Britain, were brought together by the major funding organisation in the UK, so that's the Medical Research Council. They were brought together to form a committee of human genetics, and they were tasked with assessing where funding should go to in the UK that would promote this new field of human genetics. Some of the members of that organisation were JBS Haldane, R.A. Fisher, and Lionel Penrose. So they were all quite well known at that time, and they simultaneously got very interested in all this new work that was happening on the continent on blood groups and their inheritance. And they were so excited by this that they talked about blood groups at their very first meeting. And R.A. Fisher, who was one of the members of that committee, he was a already well-established statistician and geneticist. He managed to get funding from the Rockefeller Foundation in New York to set up a lab devoted to the study of blood groups and their genetics. So he had this lab running from 1934, 1935 at University College in central London. And things were going well. They had a fair amount of data. They were collecting blood groups. They were collecting data on blood groups of hundreds of people around London. But as war got closer and more visible, various people in London began to think about about a wartime transfusion service, which was understood then to be really a vital air raid defense measure against the anticipated bombing of London. And during the course of that planning, where they planned to use new technologies of blood storage to carry out these mass blood collections and lots of transfusions, they turned to Fisher and his lab and asked the lab members if they would be willing to carry out some of the practical blood grouping work of the transfusion service. So the lab, the sort of lab manager, who was a pathologist called George Taylor, was asked to lead the training of what were known in that they referred to as blood grouping girls in London to carry out blood grouping tests. They were also charged with creating standardized antisera, so that's the reagents for doing blood grouping tests for the transfusion services. And then when war actually broke out, the Medical Research Council co-opted Fisher's lab and made it part of the emergency blood transfusion service. The lab was moved out of University College to Cambridge, into the pathology department in Cambridge. And there it was expected to devote its time to doing this practical work for the transfusion services. Meanwhile, Fisher himself desperately tried to stay on at University College, but was chucked out because University College closed its doors. He found himself a lab space at his old research institute, at a plant breeding institute in Rothamsted, just north of London. And from there, he decided to take advantage of the new institutional connection between his lab and the transfusion service and try to leverage large quantities of data from the blood depots, blood group data, which he then used to do research. So to study the blood groups of the British population and to think about experiments on the inheritance of new blood groups which were being discovered. And that institutional connection, so between R.A. Fisher, who was a preeminent geneticist, and the blood transfusion service that was using all of the practical knowledge that his lab members had gained, that really consolidated during the war and then endured after the war in new ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating that such a progress has been made in population genetics and even before the molecular discovery of the gene in the 50s. So it's quite a big amount of work.
Yes, it's a really interesting episode, I think, that not only that it was prior to molecular biology, but also that so much happened during these conditions of war, and not just in spite of the war, but precisely because of it, because of all of this, because of all of the efforts that were being made to extract blood and move it between people's bodies.
So then the rhesus blood groups were also discovered. So can you tell me what specifically is it and what was the importance?
Okay, sure. So I won't go into the technical controversies around the rhesus blood groups. It's a fascinating story and a very lengthy one. But it's perhaps sufficient to say that the discovery of the rhesus blood groups, their definition in 1940, and the way that they were then taken up by the Galton Serum Unit and R.A. Fisher in the subsequent years, and became a real focus of their research in Cambridge, using the serum from rhesus monkeys and first local women in the hospital, the local hospital, Addenbrooke's Hospital, but increasingly using samples of blood sent to them from blood depots and hospitals all around Britain. It became a really major focus of their research and established the Galton Serum Unit in Cambridge, the wartime lab, as the preeminent experts in blood groups and their genetics.
So having so many different parts that are a part of this blood grouping, is that the time where when the nomenclature was standardized predominantly or started being standardized?
Yes. So nomenclatures are always difficult to standardize. Even the ABO blood groups that Landsteiner had so named in 1900 came to be called other things in the 1920s and 30s and really only became re-standardized at the end of the 1930s with with the development of new international societies of blood transfusion. So even the ABO blood groups were a little bit hard to standardize. The rhesus blood groups, as the numbers of rhesus blood groups, the complexities of those blood groups emerged, there was huge controversy about the nomenclatures that should be used to denote them. And the nomenclatures became to be associated with different theories about how serological reactions happened and how these blood groups were inherited. And the rhesus blood groups, some listeners will know that even today, go by two distinct nomenclatures. And that has its origins during this wartime period.
So as you mentioned, in the early 20th century, the blood transfusions were predominantly used during the war efforts as a very sort of last resort operation as such. And how did we start using it more in the medical practice during surgeries or neonatal care?
That's a good question. So certainly before the Second World War, transfusions were still quite rare and were used in emergency situations. And when the emergency blood transfusion service was set up in Britain, that was the wartime service, they anticipated that it would be crucial for emergency situations, so extreme shock and blood loss. As the war went on, doctors were finding and surgeons were finding blood increasingly useful for all sorts of other purposes. So for anemias, including the anemia caused by rhesus incompatibility, but also more chronic anemias. By the late 1940s, so once the war was over, surgeons were beginning to find blood pretty indispensable for the kinds of operations that they were doing. So that's not just emergency operations, but routine operations. And blood grouping would happen in advance on the patient in order to line up blood that could be used during an operation. So this was a really big shift. And it meant that once the war was over, so once the emergency situation was over, there was nevertheless a never-ending increase in the need for blood. So more and more donors needed to be recruited.
Did this also include the centralized blood collection services in Britain?
Yes. Yeah, so during the war, blood collections were increasingly sort of networked and to some extent centralized. They were being defined and controlled from the Ministry of Health or from the Medical Research Council and then the Ministry of Health in London. after the war ended and coinciding with the establishment of the new National Health Service, which in many ways was built on the wartime systems for wartime medical systems, the blood collections began to be organized in line with the National Health Service organization. So were to some extent centralized. It was a regional service, so it extended to all parts of the country and had regional centers around the country, which coincided with the NHS defined regions. And then it was to some extent overseen by the Ministry of Health in London, and the directors of those various regional depots around the country would travel to London on a regular basis to meet and discuss problems, make plans, coordinate publicity campaigns, and so on.
So the regional centre organisation, it seemed to have really paved the way for scientists to have an access to more samples, which are really traced to the donors. And this helped pave the way to discovery of the rare blood groups. So what are those?
Yeah, so from the beginning of the war, really, the conditions that I've described led to this intensive interest in blood groups and access to hundreds of thousands of blood samples. So there was this amazingly abundant material for doing research. And in different parts of the country, blood depot directors and workers were always keeping an eye out on problematic transfusion reactions that couldn't be explained by the existing blood group. So they couldn't be explained using the tests already in use by those depots. So whenever a transfusion proceeded quite badly, so a patient might react to the blood that they were being given, the surgeon in charge would fill out a form and send it back to the depot with the bottle of blood, and then that could be traced back to the donor. And then the blood depot serologist would have the ability to then follow up that problem and try to understand why the blood of the donor and the blood of the recipient didn't mix. And in that way, they brought to light those serologists, those people working in depots and in pathology labs in hospitals, made visible a whole new range of blood groups that were causing problems in a small number of patients. And so the numbers of blood groups that were known about expanded dramatically. And after the war was over and blood began to be used much more routinely in surgery and in neonatal care, there was much greater attention being given to these subtle differences in blood type. So these much more subtle blood groups or fine details of the serological difference, which sometimes make a difference to the outcome of transfusion. And as these routine processes began to be more widespread, much more attention was being focused now on that very rare blood that had a special blood type that might be needed for a specific patient in a hurry. And this led to a number of newspaper appeals. So for example, there was a newspaper appeal around 1950 for blood of a very rare type that was needed for a woman who had to have this vital operation. And the newspapers followed these stories and breathlessly updated their readers on blood that had been flown in from elsewhere in Europe or even from Australia. And then often these stories would end up with this kind of happy conclusion of a blood type being found and a donor happily giving their blood and the recipient being saved. So it was a question of attention and the fact that blood transfusion was so much safer now. It was so much more routine, and it meant that greater attention was being given to the specificities of blood. And the rare blood donor became a bit of a figure, I mean, sort of in popular culture. So there were multiple radio plays on the BBC about rare blood and an emergency search for rare blood. There was quite a successful film called Emergency Call that came out, I think, in 1952, which centered around the search for rare blood that would be needed to save a dying child. And I should say that actually in the US, this interest in rare blood was even more intense. There were rare blood clubs that were set up, and people were, there's some wonderful stories from a scholar called Susan Lederer who writes about this and the interest in rare blood and its connection to the Cold War and concerns about the atomic bomb and whose blood might be valuable in that kind of situation. There's stories of blood groups being tattooed onto people's arms and so on. So there was this really real flourishing interest in rarity and who had the most valuable blood. And actually those kinds of stories still exist in magazines today. The Man with the Golden Blood was a recent example.
So as we move through the decades and more research is underway on the blood itself, and Arthur Morant's blood group, Reference Laboratory, played quite a central role in it. I was just wondering, when was this decoupling underway between the blood transfusion and genetics?
Thank you. Yes, you're right. So in the UK, where a lot of cutting-edge blood group research was happening, this institutional connection between genetics, serology research, and blood transfusion really remained in place for a couple of decades after the Second World War. So after the war ended, what had been Fisher's lab in Cambridge was disbanded, but then reconstituted as two new labs at the Lister Institute in London. Excuse me. And at the Lister Institute, there were these two labs. One was the Blood Group Research Unit, which was devoted to carrying out research on the genetics and inheritance of blood groups. And that was headed by Robert Race. And next door, Arthur Morant ran the Blood Group Reference Laboratory, which was meant to do the more practical work of making antisera, so the reagents for doing blood grouping, and standardizing that antisera and distributing it. And those two labs continued their role as real centers for doing blood group research. Morant, meanwhile, ran an additional institution. He was the director of a center at the Royal Anthropological Institute, also in central London, which was devoted to the collection of large quantities of data on the blood groups of populations around the world. And so he became an author of some massive compendia of blood group distributions that made inferences about human evolution and migration and racial difference. And so that continued, that work really continued for a couple of decades. It was really the 1950s and then the 1960s that blood groups began to lose their status as the preeminent genetic traits for humans. So as I mentioned before, they were very abundant. They had quite clear-cut, quite interesting genetics. So they were the focus of a lot of attention. But from the early 1950s, there was new research interest in the hemoglobin proteins of blood. Later on, in the late 1950s, various enzymes in blood, which seemed to have a clear-cut genetic inheritance, and a really flourishing interest in human genetics and particularly human population genetics and how populations of the world differ genetically became focused less on the blood groups, although that was still the case, but also on all of these other new, quite interesting traits like hemoglobin and enzymes and so on. So blood groups began to sort of lose their cutting edge status, I suppose, became incorporated into a much more expansive research program on human genetics.
And of course, all of these really startling advances in human genetics could not have been done without collection of such a huge, vast amounts of data. And of course, nowadays, we're all very, very careful about our data and sharing. So I'm just wondering, what can we learn from the history about maybe ethical implications from the story?
It's really interesting to reflect on how particularly human population genetics changed, but also carried over legacies from the period that I've been writing about. So the sorts of blood collections that Morant was doing, or that he was collating, I mean, he didn't really carry out these collections himself. He wrote to correspondents all around the world in order to collect together new data on blood groups of different populations. So, and then that expanded to encompass other kinds of traits. And this continued really till the early 1990s. Even 1992 was probably the last major compilation of data on all on sort of totalizing compilation of data on human traits in populations around the world. But these were phenotypic traits. So these are things like the blood groups or like hemoglobin or other biochemical features of humans. And it was then, I think, 1994, when very famously, Luca Luigi Cavalli Sforza established what was known as the Human Genome Diversity Project, which was an attempt to do similar kinds of work, so collecting large quantities of data from populations around the world, but using genetic data, data on genetic variation, sequence variation, rather than of the phenotypic proteins, the protein variation of humans. So, and that project, the Human Genome Diversity Project, in its methods, continued to have echoes of the past. So there's a really wonderful book by Jenny Reardon called Race to the Finish, which describes how the Human Genome Diversity Project relied on or attempted to carry out these large-scale collections of blood, principally from indigenous people around the world, and who were really, really taken aback or surprised by the pushback that they received from this kind of activity. And the Human Genome Diversity Project, in many ways, is a direct descendant of some of the collection programs that Morant was overseeing and using in his work on human populations.
So, while researching the book, what was the most interesting and exciting discovery you came across?
This is a bit of a, in a sense, a bit of a nerdy answer, but the most surprising thing that happened to me was that. Very close to the end of the project. So I think I had just given my PhD supervisor the very first draft of the whole book. I happened to meet somebody at a party locally in Cambridge who I was chatting to about these issues and about blood. And I had heard that some frozen blood from this period that I'm telling you about, from the 1960s, still existed in Cambridge. And this person said to me, I think there's also some papers somewhere as well. I don't know if you'd be interested in these papers. And I followed it up after this party. And he took me to the Department of Biological Anthropology tea room. And inside the tea room, there were shelves and shelves and shelves lined with about, I'd say, 200 boxes of archive material that had come from Arthur Morant, so the main protagonist, one of the main protagonists in my story. So in all of the years I'd been researching this using those archives at the Wellcome, which I began with, I'd never actually found any material that came from Morant's own archive. So all of that massive quantity of data that he accumulated in London on the blood groups of populations around the world. I'd never actually seen any of that material, and I was a bit confused by it. It turned out it was all in this tea room in the department very next door to HPS, where I was doing my PhD, and it had been sitting there for 20 years. Morant never worked in Cambridge, so it wasn't at all obvious that it should be there. But it turned out it had arrived in Cambridge through quite a circuitous route and was just sitting on these shelves. So it was completely astonishing. I was really shaken and I didn't know what to do, because it's beautiful, you know, it's an incredible collection, but I'm no archivist and I don't know how to evaluate that kind of material or know how to sort it or how to look at it. And eventually I was able to contact the archivists at the Wellcome Library, who came and assessed it. It was just fascinating watching them work, watching them assess this collection. And they eventually acquired it, and it's now at the Wellcome being catalogued. So I've used tiny, tiny amounts because I've leafed through some of the material, but it was just an overwhelming quantity of stuff. So once that's catalogued, and they're fantastic at doing this kind of work there, I will go and have a nice look one day.
Wow, this is treasures of forgotten filing cabinets and shelves. So in the book, you also use quite a few images and illustrations, and they really complement the book. So why did you use those?
A lot of the illustrations, I have to thank a student colleague of mine, so someone who was doing their PhD at the same time as me, and who I learned a massive amount from. So this was somebody called Nick Whitfield, and he was writing a PhD about cultures of blood donation in wartime Britain. And he had found some of the wonderful pictures. They were originally publicity photos, actually, of the wartime transfusion service, and not just the sort of head figures or the well-known people, but also there's some lovely photos of the person sharpening needles at the depot, or somebody who was washing the bottles at the depot. So all of these characters who are often out of sight, but who are incredibly important for understanding how this medical service, but also by extension, this science of human genetics was built. It was really built using the labor of these people. And so I was really grateful to find those kinds of images. The other images that I really love in this book come from a remarkable little pamphlet that was published in 1952, I think, by UNESCO, that was part of a highly visible campaign that UNESCO launched, that attempted to use science to sort of dispel notions of racial prejudice. So it's called the anti-racism campaign. And it's very famous for various reasons. But one of the lesser known elements of that campaign was this book that was published for children, a picture book, which has these beautiful sort of modernist images, which are depicting how genetics, how we should be thinking about genetics and the insights that it gives us into race science. So I guess that was the other source of, and actually the cover of the book, which I like very much. I think the designer was brilliant coming up with this. The cover of the book is based on one of the images from that book, from the UNESCO 1952 volume, What is Race?
Yes, I found visuals really helpful to sort of try time travel into those eras.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, do you know your own blood group?
I do. I've actually forgotten it momentarily. I do donate blood, so I have had my blood group disclosed to me. We also once attempted to, you can buy blood grouping tests on Amazon. And the reason I did that was because these tests that one can buy are almost identical to some tests that were invented in the 1950s, which I write about, which were blood grouping tests that could happen on paper or card, which had the reagents for the tests soaked into a card. And then you were meant to add the blood samples to the card and read off the blood group. And we tried that. So me and my partner tried it. We determined his blood type. We laminated the card, which came with the instructions. And then we discovered when he went to donate blood that it was totally wrong. So So there were lots of controversies about the efficacy of this method, and it's clearly still a problem.
I myself have benefited once from the blood transfusion, and after reading your book, I have a better appreciation of the nowadays seemingly routine procedure of the transfusion, which has such a rich history.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I would like to ask, what are you currently working on and what is your next project?
Thank you. I've just started this new project. I say just started. I started it officially last March, but things have been a bit slow in starting. It's in some ways a continuation of this, or it certainly has a relationship to the blood project. So I'm very interested in how my overall sort of question that motivates me now is thinking, how has genetics become such a powerful way of understanding human health and human identity and human history? And so the book we've been talking about goes a little way towards thinking about that. My next project does more of that. So I'm interested in understanding how genetics or human genetics has been talked about and communicated since the Second World War. And I'm embarking on that by focusing on the history of genetic counselling, which is a medical specialty of professionals who help patients and prospective parents sometimes to interpret the results of genetic tests. And that profession, which has really only been a profession for 30 years or so, has a much longer history. So genetic counselling has been something that's been happening since the Second World War, and has got a very interesting history. And so I am now starting to recover what that history looks like, how communication in this sort of medical genetic setting has changed over the last 70 years.
Sounds very exciting and an important project. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and your book?
There's the book. The details of the book are on the University of Chicago Press website. I'm still to write much about the new project, but I have a website at my university, which is Queen Mary University of London. I'm in the School of History, I'm not really sure if that was a good answer. Sorry.
Excellent. Yep. So thank you very much for joining me today and sharing with us this gripping story.
It was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.